Well, may we say God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema is a four-weekly podcast which looks at and recommends movies that are more than 20 years old. The good, the obscure, the interesting, and the weird. Feedback is important. You can email it to cultguru with a K at gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U at gmail.com. Visit the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook or leave a recorded voicemail or comment at paleocinema.blogspot.com or drop a voicemail at our new number 206-309-4864. This podcast may contain adult concepts and language, but please don't be disappointed if it doesn't.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 117. My name is Terry Frost, and I am recording at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning because I have a guest. And my guest is Vince Rotolo from the B-Movie Podcast. How are you, Vince?
We're doing good. It's a little bit earlier than it is over there. Well, it's real early over there. But, yeah, we had a little bit of trouble hooking up because of the crazy time zones and stuff.
Yeah, we did. But I think we got there eventually. And given the fact that the movie we're talking about is Taxi Driver, I'm kind of working Travis Bickle hours to get this podcast done.
Yeah, I know about working night shifts too. When you shut down for an outage, we work long hours, night shifts. So I kind of know where you're coming from.
Yeah, I did that for a while in the 80s. I worked night shift at a post office, sorting mail and parcels. So, yeah, that got a bit crazy. And I've got a lot of sympathy for the character in this film because of that. You know, a working night shift in a city is an interesting experience. But anyway, before we get into that stuff, there's a couple of things I want to do. First off, I want to talk to you. How long have you been podcasting now? It's got to be 6 or 7 years.
Since 2000 and probably 7, I guess.
Yeah, same as me. So 2007, what's that make it? 6 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing the same thing. And how did you get into it?
Oh, geez. I don't know. I think I had heard about podcasts. I started listening to a few of them, and I thought, you know, that'd be kind of cool thing to do for a hobby. And, you know, I really love the old B-movies, the classic sci-fi and horror kind of stuff. So I think I was listening to Cinema Slave was out there then. It's not there anymore.
Yeah.
And a couple other ones. And so I just kind of decided to do it, and I did it a while by myself, but I'm not really the kind of person that could do that. So then I finally hooked up with Nick. I was looking for a co-host, and then he started doing it with me. And, you know, when I first started, I just got some cheap equipment, and then I would sell it and upgrade and learn. And it's been a learning experience for the last, you know, 5 years too. So,
yeah, I mean, I tend to do the solo thing a little more than most podcasters. And like I told some people once, podcasting by yourself is like masturbation. It takes a lot of skill to do it and maintain the interest of an audience.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't, you know, keep talking like that. But yeah, I did. I tried it a few of them, and, you know, people write in and say, you know, you sound like a robot and all this stuff.
Yeah, you sound like a fucking robot. Yeah,
got that a lot. So, you know, they like,
hey, you sound like you're not from around here, yeah, but you don't sound like a robot.
So anyway, you know, when I got Nick, that was cool because you can kind of play off each other. And then I think I've been listening to yours since kind of day one. It kind of feels like I know you, even though, you know, you're on the other side of the world and stuff. That's the cool thing about podcasting and stuff.
Absolutely. And it's always nice when Mary comes on board too and does it with you as well. Getting her viewpoint on some things is always a bit interesting.
Yeah. See, I mean, we did it for a long time, and then I said, hey, you know, you might as well come up and join us. You're just sitting down there anyway. So hooked her into reading the email and stuff, and now she's been part of it for a while too. But
Absolutely, and she does provide that kind of balance for you guys, which is kind of nice as well. I mean, I got Sal on a couple of times, mm-hmm. but every time I'm about to get her on, I do something to piss her off. So she goes, no, I'm not fucking doing it now. Okay, well, fair enough. And I gave up asking after a while because of that.
But we do it. We do a weekly one, too. The bear's like, oh, yeah. We got to do this again. Yeah, get in.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's got to be a support group for podcasters, partners, and things like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I've been listening to your stuff since almost the start as well. I mean, very early on, maybe when you got into double digits.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, you've got that endless supply of really mediocre and bad B-movies to play with there, and you got one there supplying all sorts of stuff from south of the border.
Yeah, it's like and, endless.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing, too, about doing this kind of stuff and being a movie buff in general, finding those obscure things that hardly anybody knows about mm-hmm. and just sharing them. It's a joyous thing to do.
And, you know, there's other, I like all different kind of cinema and stuff. And, you know, on our podcast, we don't get to talk about different things. And, you know, there's movies and at certain times in your life, you see a movie that just will blow you away or it just burns up those things into your brain or your retinas or whatever you don't forget. So I thought, you know, I would get up with you. I kind of called Terry and invited myself on the show.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I got no problem with that at all. It takes the pressure right off me. But, yeah, I mean, Taxi Driver is a great choice. We were going to do another movie with it, but mostly because of me, we didn't get our shit together with that. But I'll get you on again.
Sure. Where
we can organize time zones. And if you've got something that you want to talk about that doesn't really fit in with the B-movie cast,
mm-hmm.
please. I mean, I'm always happy to have a chat about stuff. And, give it a plug. Give your podcast a plug while we're here in case there are about three people out there that haven't listened to it.
Or just at bmoviecast.com, and we do a weekly podcast, like I was saying, on classic horror and sci-fi and stuff. We've been doing the thing, a Ray Harryhausen tribute, since Ray just passed away. So we've been doing that, and tomorrow will be 250, I think. So.
Well, congratulations for 250, mate. I mean, that's an incredible effort.
Yeah,
just getting to 100 was an effort for me, but 250 is incredibly remarkable.
Yeah, man, that's about it. I mean, like I said, mainly the people that listen to our show listen to yours, I think. Cause
yeah, there's a bit of overlap, but the other thing, too, is that I'll hook people up with the B-movie cast as well because I know a lot of people in Australia who listen to podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
I can kind of bring them to your stuff as well, which is kind of nice.
Sure. And Terry got links on his site, and I got links back to you. So,
yeah, but it's a big circle jerk with podcasting, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll move on from there. And thanks for suggesting it, because I have wanted to get you and a lot of other people on. And I will be getting more co-hosts in future on a rotating basis. But what have you been watching?
It takes time. It just takes, you know, time and everything. Every time I hear your podcast at work, you know, when it pops up, I listen to it. It's first what I usually listen to and stuff. And, you know, I make notes. I got a call in that I don't know where the time goes, you know. It's just
Real life interviews with podcasting, doesn't it?
Yeah, way too much.
Okay, so what have you been watching lately?
Let's see. Well, I just finished watching First Men in the Moon, since that's what we're going to do tomorrow. So I figured it might be a good idea to watch that.
Lionel Jeffries. Uh-huh. Always like a Lionel Jeffries movie. Do you know when he did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with Dick Van Dyke?
Mm-hmm.
He played his father. He was younger than Dick Van Dyke at the time. Lionel Jeffries looked like 60 years old from birth.
Yeah, there's people that are like that. I've read that about some different actors and stuff.
And I think it was in either The Vikings or The Longships, one of those Viking mm-hmm. movies that came out in the early 60s. And he's in there with a bald head playing an Arab. And it's really weird because you've got a certain picture of Lionel Jeffries playing eccentric English people. And in that movie, he plays a bald Arab.
Wow. Strange.
Yeah, there are those kind of things that pop up too. Anything else you've been watching?
Let's see. I watched House on Telegraph Hill the other night on Netflix streaming. That was pretty good film noir.
Haven't seen that one. It must have been on my radar.
Lady's in a concentration camp, and she befriends this other lady, and the other lady dies, but she had been talking to her, and she had a rich aunt somewhere in San Francisco, and so she, like, took her papers and kind of moved in there and said that was her kid and stuff like that. And it was pretty interesting, though.
Oh, cool. I think it's a Dirk Bogarde movie, which has a similar plot, but with it being a male rather than a female.
Richard Basehart was in it. He was her husband, real crazy.
Yeah, Richard Basehart always had an ambiguous feeling about it. I mean, I first saw him in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, playing Admiral Nelson.
Yeah.
But everything else I saw him in, he was always a bit of a bastard. He never played a likable character, really, did he?
He said the same thing in this one.
Yeah, I mean, some people get so typecast with these things. So what have I been watching? I watched Battle Beneath the Earth with Kerwin Matthews.
I don't think I've ever seen that one.
Basically, it's supposed to have been set in America, but it was filmed in England with English actors, including English actors with funny eye things to play Chinese people. It's from about mid-1960s, and it's about a secret plan by a Chinese general to use lasers to tunnel from China to America and invade America.
Mm.
And it's incredibly silly. And I had a bit of fun watching that. What else have I seen? I watched a movie called Rapture Palooza. It's a rapture comedy, which is not too bad, with Craig Robinson in it. The funny thing is that all the good bits are in the trailer.
Yeah, they have
that
a
one,
lot.
Which caused a bit of consternation with me, because I was kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it never did. So it does end on a very nice atheist note, which I fully appreciate. But it's worth checking out if you get a little bit of time to do it. I know the other thing I'd mentioned that I've seen recently is I rewatched The Two Jakes, the sequel to Chinatown that Jack Nicholson directed. And I'll always maintain that that's an incredibly underrated movie. I really do like it.
Harvey Keitel's in that. That's a good movie. I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of these days I may do it on the podcast as well, because I did Chinatown a fair way back, I think. It's hard to remember after so many. I really wanted to hit The Two Jakes, and given the 20-year time limit on Paleo Cinema, Two Jakes has just slipped under that 20 years. It was made in 1990, so I can hit that one when the time comes and have a bit of fun with it. But anyway, what we're talking about tonight is a Martin Scorsese movie. For the second podcast in a row, I'm doing a Scorsese movie, having done Boxcar Bertha.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
In the previous podcast. And this one, directed by, of course, Marty Scorsese, written by Paul Schrader. Starring Robert De Niro, whatever happened to him, Harvey Keitel's in there, Jodie Foster, Sybil Shepherd, Albert Brooks.
Second call, 4-1-4 Hamilton, 4-1-7.
4-9-5, Alfano, 448. De Niro, in Bang the Drum Slowly, the critics called him a brilliant new talent. After Mean Streets, they said he was a genius. For his performance in The Godfather Part II, they gave him the Academy Award.
Come on, man. Just get me out of here, all right?
Now, Robert De Niro creates a terrifying portrait of life on the edge of madness.
Tabby, just forget about this. It's nothing.
Taxi Driver, a film by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, people do anything in front of a taxi driver. I mean anything. People too cheap to rent a hotel room.
Oh, driver, hurry up, will you?
People want to embarrass you. It's like you're not even there. It's like, you know, like a taxi driver doesn't even exist.
This city here is like an open sewer, you know? It's full of filth and scum.
I think I know what you mean, Travis. But it's not going to be easy.
You guys get to be a Secret Service man.
What?
Well, I was just curious because I thought maybe I'd make a good one. Hey, what kind of guns do you guys carry?
38s, 45s, 357 Magnums, something bigger maybe.
Hi. I'd like to volunteer.
Why?
Why? Because I think that you are the most beautiful woman I've ever seen.
The taxi driver is looking for a target. Getting ready. Getting organized. Preparing himself for the only moment in his life that will ever mean anything.
How much for everything?
$350 for the Magnum, $250 for the 38, $1.25 for the 25, $150 for the 380.
That taxi driver's been staring at us.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I don't know who's weirder, you or me.
You talking to me? Then who the hell else are you talking? Talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
I don't believe I've ever met anyone quite like you.
Oh, yeah?
You will never see a more chilling performance than this. Robert De Niro in Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Jodie Foster, Albert Brooks, Harvey Keitel, Leonard Harris, Peter Boyle, Sybil Shepherd, Taxi Driver.
Just let me know why you brought this one to me.
Well, like I said, you know, there's certain movies you see, and especially at certain time periods, maybe in your life or something, and they have such an impact on you. When I saw this, I think I was 25 when it came out, went into the theater with my brother, and that's back in the days where I didn't know anything about movies. You just go in and watch a movie, you know?
Yeah.
And we went in, saw The Taxi Driver. We were just so blown away. I can remember like walking out of the theater. It's like, you know, what the hell did we just see? You know, there was like really nothing out there like that at the time, you know?
Mm. And there's been a hell of a lot of things like it since then, is probably one of the indications of a successful movie. I was actually having a look because there are similarities in a couple of ways of this film with Death Wish, the Charles Bronson thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which Michael Winner did. And this came out 2 years after Death Wish, but it's a much better film, looking into kind of the vigilante thing. And there were a few vigilantes around, I know, in America in the 1970s who'd go around and kill people at random or kill people they thought were bad and things like that. It did seem to be a bit of a popular sport around the same time that streaking was.
I don't think this was really, I don't even consider this a vigilante movie. It's just a guy that's just getting more and more psychotic, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, you know, Death Wish is like, oh, you killed, raped my wife, I'm going to kill you kind of thing. But for him, he was just, you know, he was just out there kind of.
Absolutely. I'll read the blurb from the back of the Blu-ray, which is kind of the best one I could find. Vietnam vet Travis Bickle, played by Robert De Niro, works as a loner night shift cabbie in New York. Roving the streets, he kills time by keeping a diary, popping pills, and hanging out in porn theaters. A series of frustrations and his encounters with a 14-year-old prostitute, played by Jodie Foster, compel him to clean up the sordid world in which he operates. So that pretty much covers it there.
Yeah.
And, did have a bit of trouble getting the movie because I had a brain fart. I knew I'd bought a copy of Taxi Driver on Blu-ray. I'd forgotten that I gave it to someone as a birthday present.
Oh, jeez.
So this morning I get up and I'm looking around and going, okay, it's not in with the Blu-rays. I'll see if I put it somewhere else. So I go into the other shelves and I don't have a copy. So I was waiting outside JB Hi-Fi, which is the place I get all the Blu-rays at. When it opened this morning, actually yesterday morning now, to get a copy. And I picked up, it was on the two for $10 Blu-rays.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, two for $20. So I picked up this and a copy of a Scandinavian crime film called Headhunters.
I've been wanting to see that for a long time. It's in my Netflix queue.
Yeah, Headhunters, I definitely recommend. It's full-on gritty and a little bit slightly futuristic in some of the technologies. But let me know what you think when you watch it, because I'm going to rewatch it after I get some sleep today and go with it. But
so,
anyway.
So tell me, is this the first time you've seen Taxi Driver before, I take it?
I saw it on VHS originally.
Oh, wow.
Back in the day. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard a lot about it, and I'd seen I saw Raging Bull and a few other things before this. And of course I saw Boxcar Bertha way back when I was 15 years old and snuck into the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of, Scorsese was on my radar to some extent. I've only seen Mean Streets once, and I really should revisit Mean Streets because...
Yeah, same with me. I've seen it once.
Yeah, but De Niro in this, it surprised me a bit because De Niro a little bit is kind of resting on his laurels these days. He hasn't done anything really interesting for about 10 years. And seeing the young, vital, crazy De Niro... Mm-hmm. Was a kind of refreshing thing. And I've kind of got a sympathy for the world that Travis Bickle has in this movie because around the same time, this came out in 1976, I was hanging around the red light districts in Sydney as a teenager, where the pimps and the prostitutes were and the late night cab drivers and all the neon and things like that. It wasn't quite as extensive as it is around Times Square in New York, but it wasn't an entirely different place. So I kind of, it had a weird familiarity to me watching it this time.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, in 72 when this came out, we're from the Pittsburgh area, and it was same thing like that, you know, all the porn movies and the lights and all that stuff. It was same. And, you know, I think Schrader said this was pretty much meant to be like any city. You know, it was in New York, but it could have been any city.
Well, Schrader's original script had it set in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
But when Scorsese came on board, De Palma was originally going to direct it, Brian De Palma. Mm-hmm. And what happened was he got the sack from the studio. And the producers... Michael Phillips and his wife, I'm just trying to remember her name. She wrote a really good book called You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again about her experiences as a producer. Just let me see if I can find her name because she's really important in the history of 1970s cinema. Let's see, Taxi Driver. And this is fascinating for the people listening, of course.
I know the studios didn't want to touch it.
No, it was an incredibly transgressive movie, and it still is in some ways. And we can talk about the Michael and Julia Phillips.
Julia Phillips. Yeah.
If anyone gets a chance to grab a copy of her book, You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again, about her experiences producing in Hollywood during the crazy cocaine years of the 1970s and 1980s. It's a thick book, but it's an incredibly good read. But, so that kind of world is... a familiar thing. And I did actually get to Times Square in 1998, and I did go into a couple of the last couple of porno theaters and arcades and things that they had around Times Square. But the one thing that really struck me, there's a scene in this film where Travis Bickle goes into a record shop, and I got intensely nostalgic for record shops, not like CD shops. Or DVD shops, but good old-fashioned record shops where you flick through the records.
Well, I've just got back into vinyl recently. In fact, there's a stack of them laying on my floor again, and I had about 300 of them in the other room, but I kind of been – there's some vintage ones in town here I go through. I just love going through all those records and stuff.
Yeah, and I've got a stack of them, too, that I'm slowly digitizing. But, I just felt incredibly nostalgic about that. But the world that Scorsese and Schrader really set up is kind of a hellish place. And there's, on the Blu-ray, I did watch a couple of the extras, and they had a chat with cab drivers who had been guys who were cab drivers during the 1970s. And they said, yeah, it was like that. It was really a fucking dangerous place to be.
But, you know,
yeah.
Schrader, he was like 26 when he wrote this. This movie is one of those perfect storms, you know, actually. Yeah. But he was like 26, and he was kind of in meltdown mode. He was, you know, a drunk living in his car. He broke up with his wife, and he finally got hospitalized with an ulcer. So that's where he was laying in bed in the hospital, and he wrote about Arthur Bremer. That's the guy that tried to assassinate George Wallace, you remember?
Yep.
So... he got to reading that. That was kind of like the germ for the screenplay, you know. So he, you know, and Bremer wrote all these diaries. He actually had real diaries when he was tracking. I think he was going after the president first and then switched to the governor or something.
Yeah, you pick the easier target after you take a look at the president, I suppose.
Yeah, but so, you know, that's where this came from kind of like a real thing. Plus, he said he's Travis Bickle because that's the way he was feeling at the time. You know, it was like the bottom of his life, kind of, you know.
Yeah, well, Schrader came from a weird background, too. He came from a very strict, kind of off-the-track religious group.
A Calvinist or something.
Some kind of Calvinist mm-hmm. offshoot. And he knew about movies, but he hadn't seen very many of them. He loved movies, but he'd only seen a few of them because his parents thought they were evil. And so he went to L.A. and went to film school with people like Lucas and John Milius and people like that, and then Spielberg,
mm-hmm.
Mostly so he could see movies.
And then I think he was a critic for a while or something.
Like he was. He was actually Pauline Kael, the great movie critic, was a mentor to him,
mm-hmm.
and she suggested that he do a film course to become a better critic because he was fascinated by movies and but hadn't seen many. And this, of course, was before you could go down and rent a copy of a film.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to see a movie, you had to put your bum in a seat with a projector behind your head and watch one. And that's how Schrader got into it, by Pauline Kael just mentoring him and giving him that opportunity to find out what he did well. And of course, Taxi Driver being the first big splash of that.
He said he wrote it in like 10 days. He said, just come out of me like a monster or something.
Yeah, he was squatting and he left his wife. He moved in with a girlfriend. The girlfriend had thrown him out, yeah. But she went away for a while, so he was flat-sitting for a girlfriend. He said he didn't feel comfortable sleeping in her bed, so he slept on the couch and wrote on the dining room table and just got the thing out in a kind of anguished burst of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't make up stories like that. I mean, classic film. And it's been considered, I think on the list I saw, it was the 31st best movie in movie history.
Yeah, Barry always hates it. It's a disturbing movie, you know, when you think about the implications. I mean, when this thing was written, you know, we had had the Vietnam War, which is kind of like a failed war. The economy was bad and guys were coming back with, even though they didn't, I guess, call it post-traumatic stress. I'm sure that's what he had.
Yeah, the shell shock, they were calling it then.
Yeah, and now...
Yeah, absolutely, and I reckon he has. I mean, I've got post-traumatic stress disorder to a certain degree myself. And, he does have it, the Travis Bickle character. He's got all the classic things, hiding away from the world, in a sense, putting himself in a bubble with the 12-hour shifts, not being able to sleep, all that kind of stuff is classic PTSD behavior.
Mm-hmm. And today we have the... You know, Afghan war and the economy, it's almost at the same place.
Yeah, but you don't have a Watergate. Watergate was the other big thing in that perfect storm as well. That kind of cynicism about the whole political process, which Taxi Driver taps into as well with the stuff with Travis Bickle meets Betsy, the character played by Sybil Shepherd, who you get the impression she is interested in a little bit of rough trade, and that's why she's a bit fascinated by Travis.
Yeah, I guess the bad boy interested her, you know.
Yeah, and she's a flirt. I mean, Sybil Shepherd, not a fantastic actress
mm-hmm.
in general, but in this kind of role, she, you know, she had a certain sexual impact and kind of works. I mean, you can see when she does a dialogue with Albert Brooks, who's playing a campaign worker mm-hmm. who's working with, that Brooks is dancing circles around Sybil Shepherd as an actor. He's doing a much better job of it than she is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing, I don't know, I think the thing was cast good. I mean, she wasn't bad, but I mean, De Niro was perfect in there. Harvey Keitel was supposed to be the politician.
Harvey Keitel was going to do the Albert Brooks role.
One of them, yeah. But he,
yeah.
I guess he said, yo, I saw the pimp role, that's what I wanted, you know, so...
Yeah, he wanted it, even though in the original script, the pimp had four lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
And, of course, Keitel had just worked with Scorsese. Scorsese did Mean Streets
mm-hmm.
with Keitel. And then he went off and did Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore as a studio picture,
mm-hmm.
which gave him the clout to get Taxi Driver made. So Keitel he'd worked with in his originally his first movie and in Mean Streets. So they were buddies, and Keitel just wanted to work with him again. So he went and did The Pimp, and Sport the Pimp is an incredibly good role.
Oh man!
And this is probably a good time to talk about the whole thing with Jodie Foster's character.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a 12-year-old actress playing a 14-year-old prostitute is something that has to be done incredibly carefully, of course. And they did use her older sister, who was 19 at the time, as a body double for some of those scenes where she's in the room with Travis and basically trying to undress him and get the deal done.
Although the cuts are so fast on those scenes, you probably couldn't tell, you know. I mean, it'd be real hard to tell.
But those were incredibly uncomfortable scenes to watch.
Yes.
As well, I mean, where Iris is being a seasoned prostitute and, of course, Travis, which is his saving grace as a character, and one of the reasons why we come to kind of like him in a weird kind of way, where he's trying to rescue this child prostitute. And those scenes where she doesn't quite get it and just wants to kind of do what her pimp Sport wants her to do.
Yeah, she's kind of brainwashed and drugged.
Yeah, and basically seduced emotionally. And there is that scene with Sport and Iris where he's telling her he loves her and stroking her hair and doing all that kind of stuff to keep her on board. And that's a dangerous place for a start for an actor like Harvey Keitel to be, acting with a 12-year-old girl in that situation.
Very convincing.
Doing it so well. Yeah, that's the thing, going that distance and going to that really dark and horrible place.
I mean, they would go, he'd go and talk to pimps and, you know, they really get into their... I mean, De Niro would fly from Italy, he was on a film, he'd fly to New York and he got a cab license and he would drive cab at night, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he was that kind of method actor, doing that kind of thing. And he talked to a lot of people from the Midwest to get that kind of flattened accent that Travis Bickle has as well. So he kind of really went the distance with this one. And, of course, he had to kind of physically be in great shape to play the character as well, with those push-ups, with the clap in between each push-up, and just in general being somebody who's kind of pared down to a real lean minimum. And, it's an awesome picture. And just seeing it again, it reminded me of the impact that directors like Scorsese had on the 1970s.
Yeah, I mean, they knew. This thing was, you know, he was from New York. It was a New York thing, and Schrader. I mean, they just all got it, you know.
Yeah, and there was an energy to them. They were hungry. They'd all come through the film school, so they were, first off, students of film. And Scorsese himself said that, and there are any number of films. He quoted maybe 15 or 20 movies that influenced the way he made this film as well, including like The Wrong Man, a Hitchcock film. So he was being influenced by Hitchcock. He was being influenced by the French New Wave directors from the 1960s. He was being influenced by Italian neorealist directors from the 1950s.
You can tell there's a lot of expressionistic type scenes in this thing. He calls it it's a mix of gothic horror and tabloid news is what he called it.
Absolutely. And it's, very much like that. And the beautiful thing about it is between Scorsese and Schrader, that ear for the vernacular and the ear for the way working people talk, there isn't a false note in it. And people like Peter Boyle playing Wizard, one of the other cab drivers, and the guys he talks to and the way they talk, and the guy who brings a piece of Errol Flynn's bathtub to try to get Travis to sell it for him, and the way these uneducated guys who are still high verbal and still communicate best between men, the way they talk is really great. I mean, Schrader went on to make Blue Collar, which is another movie that does that really well. Just that ear for working class people and the way they talk. And of course, because of that, and because of how rich and deep that is in this film, the bits between Albert Brooks and Betsy, the character played by Sybil Shepherd, it's like they're in a different movie.
Exactly. That's what I was just going to say. It's like you're watching a movie, and all of a sudden it's a different movie. Anytime you break away from Travis's point of view,
Yeah.
Which 90% of the movie is like his point of view, you know?
Yeah, it does really have a craziness to it. It was like they were suddenly in a romantic comedy from the 1940s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
when they're doing the talk cute between the two characters and things like that, and that actually works really well to support the film as well, because what it does is it shows that A, there's a class gap between Betsy and Travis. She's an educated person from upstate New York. He's a street guy, and it also shows that they're never, you know, what Travis wants is not a realistic goal. Him having her in his life is not a realistic goal for him to have. He's shooting too high and he's shooting in the wrong direction, which shows that he just doesn't understand people. He's just got no social skills.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And he's not very bright.
And when you see him, he's usually like at the restaurant, he's like away from the rest of the crowd, you know? He just he can't even like make small talk, you know, with the guys, you know?
And he's always watching people, and incredibly paranoid, particularly about black people. And Schrader and Scorsese said that Travis is a racist character.
I was asking Mary, though. You know, we watched it, and I didn't really get that too much from him.
If you look in the restaurant scenes.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was
the people he's watching
pimps.
And the black people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's watching the pimps, and he's also watching the other black people. And when he's on the street, the people he turns his head and watches most are black people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
A distrust about them, which Scorsese did. A couple of the other characters, Sport, and a couple of the other characters were going to be black.
Yeah, I think everybody that was in the shootout at the end originally was going to be.
Yeah, but they didn't want to play up the racism. They wanted it to be there, but they didn't want it to overwhelm the rest of the film.
Well, they actually thought there might be, like, you know, riots in the movie theaters if they would do something like that.
That would have been a possibility at that stage,
mm-hmm.
Particularly given the fact that the civil rights movement was so strong then.
Right.
That that having that dynamic in the film, it also would have, you know, it wouldn't have been what Scorsese and Schrader wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
But those kind of working class guys in the 70s, I know in Australia, if nowhere else, racism was pretty rife. Particularly in working class people, everybody who's downtrodden has to find someone else to look down on, and that's just the way society is set up with capitalism, where there is a class structure. Everybody in that class structure has to look down on someone. It's bad, but it happens.
Yeah, and I have to say too, the music in this, I have the soundtrack, it is so good.
Bernard Herrmann's last score.
Yeah, I mean,
finished recording it the day before he died.
It just fit this thing so well.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of some of David Raxon's scores from the early 50s as well. It's got that kind of jazz saxophone thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really reminiscent of scores like 2 Weeks in Another Town and The Bad and the Beautiful, which are two of my favorite films. It's got that feel about it. And then those kind of strident chords underlying it when there's not the jazz saxophone there. Really does. It reminds you of an old film noir, but those strident chords give you a sense of the modern menace as well. So it's an incredibly, there's two tones to the score, but it's really well balanced. It does give you that kind of sense of a strange and very dark world.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning, sometimes even 8 in the morning, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in 350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. Come out at night. Whores, skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies. Sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets.
Yeah, it can go into that, like, kind of goes into that sexy, like, love song, saxophone stuff into a real dark place, like, real quick.
It does, and that it also, because it's right from the start of the film.
Oh, yeah.
Even before we hear more than a little bit of Travis's voiceover.
I love the openings to films. They're like a piece of artwork in themselves, but this one, man, the way that there was, like, that fog, you know, and then the taxi came through there, you know. I read somewhere in a book, some woman wrote a book on it. She was saying how that reminded her of Nosferatu's coffin, you know.
Yeah. It's a bit like the taxi's coming out of hell.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I do like is scenes like that and scenes like the shootout when he kind of rescues Iris from the pimps and from the other guys.
Yeah, that was so really realistic.
Yeah, it was incredibly realistic, but Scorsese is really bold with his direction. Having that cab burst out of the steam coming up from the vents in the ground, and that scene shows that he's not scared to go really bold and sometimes a little bit obvious.
Yeah,
to get his
he does the slow-mo stuff and some of the things, like when Travis was on the phone after, you know, Betsy broke up with him or whatever, and the camera just kind of moves over and all you're looking at stuff, looking down the hallway, but you can hear him. You know, that kind of stuff's just amazing camera work on this, too.
Yeah, they said that the reason for doing that with panning the camera down the hallway is to give the audience a sense of being embarrassed by what Travis is saying.
Mm-hmm.
They're turning away from him a little bit, the way we turn away from somebody who's saying something embarrassing.
And the overhead shots, you know, where you're looking down on the, you know, when you first saw him and he came in and was trying to get the job at the taxi thing, when he walked in, he like came in out of the fog. Did you notice that? That was almost like a horror movie too.
And there's another bit too where he walks into the cafe, which is not there anymore. I checked.
Mm-hmm.
They're really groovy all night cafe there, where he's just got to push a junkie out of his way and lean him against the wall because he's just standing in the doorway there. And that's something I'm not entirely unfamiliar with from my experiences in the 1970s. There were people.
Oh, yeah.
You get it, there were drunks in the city. We got a bit of a problem with binge drinking. And, just drunk people around the place. It's like you dodge around them. It's like dodging slow zombies. And things like that. So, yeah, and the fact that he does it in such a kind of matter-of-fact way shows that it happens all the time. And then you've got the other things. You've got things like Scorsese's cameo.
Oh, yeah.
Playing the guy in the cab who's, in his own way, at least as fucked up as Travis is.
He did that so well, too, man.
Yeah. Originally, another actor was going to do it, but he got unwell. And they, at the last minute, so they had to find somebody, so Scorsese suited up and did it himself. But it just kind of gave, it was one of those scenes where maybe it goes on maybe a minute too long, but it does give you that sense of how fucked up New York is in the world of the movie.
Yeah, the whole, I mean, I just think everything about this movie is just, it's one of those things you definitely get to see if you haven't seen it, you know, I mean. And like I said, it was really had an impact on us when you first saw it at the theater. Because, I mean, there was movies like The Wild Bunch and Bonnie and Clyde and stuff. But those were, you know, The Wild Bunch was the cowboys and there's always like people getting killed. And Bonnie and Clyde was gangsters. But this guy, and you know, there's a lot of people out there like him. That's the scary part.
Yeah. And also it was set in contemporary times. It wasn't in the past like Bonnie and Clyde and The Wild Bunch. You didn't have that kind of distance of time. It was very much right then, right there. And let me see if I got the other. And of course, we've got to mention John Hinckley Jr. being influenced by this movie and trying to kill Ronald Reagan to get Jodie Foster's attention.
Yeah.
which is like reality hitting the movies big time.
Said he saw it like 15 times or something.
Yeah, which Can you imagine sitting down and watching, even being somewhat saner than Hinckley was? You would imagine you and I sitting down and watching Taxi Driver 15 times.
Oh, God.
That's got to fuck with your head.
You know, people have said, though, see, Hinckley came from oil money. You know, his family is pretty rich. And people were saying he probably just played the I'm crazy card, where the guy that in Hinckley, they shipped him off to like a nut house. He might have even got out.
No, he's still in.
Is he? But that Arthur Bremmer, he was just a messed up young kid from, you know, the South with no money, and they gave him like, 80 years or something.
Yeah, well, if you got a little bit of money, you tend to get the better deal. That's the unfortunate thing about it. But there were a couple of other actors who were going to play Travis Bickle.
Mm.
Schrader said he wrote it for Jeff Bridges after seeing The Last Picture Show, which would have been an interesting choice. And the other person that Scorsese almost had on the hook was Dustin Hoffman.
Wow.
Which I couldn't really see. I mean, Hoffman was just doing Lenny at the time, playing Lenny Bruce and doing that well. But I don't think he's right for this because, A, he's incredibly short.
Mm-hmm.
And, B, playing a Vietnam veteran is the Dustin Hoffman kind of thing.
Once you see a movie like this a couple of times, I can't imagine it without Robert De Niro in it or Harvey Keitel or Scorsese even.
Absolutely, because it is iconic of its type. It's showing the dark side of human nature and the dark side of city living, in a sense.
Yeah, definitely city living, but, the guy was, like, kind of mental, so it's not even, like, I don't know how to explain it, but...
But there are aspects of the city that kind of pushed him further.
It's almost like, he was headed to that thing the whole time. You know, he was headed down that road, but you could tell by everybody that talked to him, the way they looked at him and everything, he was headed that way. It was like, it's kind of like watching a pressure cooker just boil and boil and boil until finally, something triggers it, throws him over the edge kind of a thing.
Yeah, and also the fact that he was boozing and taking pills and things like that, and between that and insomnia, I mean, I know if I don't get enough sleep, my decision-making goes to shit in a very few days, but he was doing it for months at a time. You can tell by the dates he puts in the diaries that he was doing it for months at a time. He always had a hip flask of booze with him. He was popping pills. He wasn't getting sleep anyway. And he didn't have the reality check of close friendships, the relationships that other people have. And as Scorsese and Schrader put those pieces into place, it kind of leads you very seamlessly into the level of crazy that he eventually reaches.
And like I said, I think there's a lot of people out there, you can't really help them. I mean, psychotic people out there.
Well, Schrader said one interesting thing in the extras that I saw. He said that one of the things he kept in mind writing Travis Bickle was that loneliness is a choice people make. It's not something that's imposed upon you by the universe or by anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's the choices you make and the steps you don't take to fix a problem that lead to that. And one of the things that he wanted to do with the script was show that. And I think he did it very well.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of background on the guy, I mean, you knew very little about him. I've even read where, he might have just been saying he was in Vietnam because there wasn't a lot of proof. But I think when he took his shirt off and he was doing those push-ups and had all those scars all over his back, I figured something bad happened to him,
No, well, both Scorsese and Schrader have said, yes, he was a Vietnam veteran. And it's like the ending, there's a field of belief saying that Travis died at the shootout, and that the scenes after the shootout are a kind of dream he's having as he's dying.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's a bit like a lot of the other conspiracy theories about movies like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, saying that Ferris is an imaginary friend for Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
and things like that. People think up these theories, which have a certain interesting, but they're not really valid. And Scorsese and Schrader said that, no, Travis, there's an important bit at the end of the film after the shootout scene.
Mm-hmm.
That a certain look in De Niro's eye that says, you know, next time Travis isn't going to be perceived as a hero, and there's going to be a next time.
Yeah, he kind of jerks around at the end. And yeah, they both said yeah. that, so I'd go with what they say.
I'm willing to believe these guys. They made the bloody movie.
Well, you know, I mean, when he went after the politician, you know, just a few seconds between that and what he did at the end could have been a very different outcome for him, you know.
Absolutely. And he was only going for the politician because of that rejection. He'd actually met the politician in the car and talked to him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And respected him. But it was one of those things where that meeting and the association that Betsy has with the campaign churned in his head to kind of steer him towards that.
Yeah.
In a weird way. And I think that there's a couple of things that are really fantastic about this film, apart from all the other things we just talked about, is that the way that the three of them, Scorsese, Schrader, and De Niro, make Travis incredibly understandable.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, yeah, he is fucked up to the max, but we do understand how, even if we don't approve of it.
Yeah, you kind of feel for him, you know, even as messed up as he is.
Yeah, because we know him. We've kind of done a ride along with
right.
his life to a certain extent. And I think that's important. And one of the other things that I found really pointed and important too is, if you look at Travis's handwriting, it's very, very primitive.
Mm-hmm.
It's all capital block letters, and it's almost childlike, the handwriting. Which shows that maybe Travis has some kind of learning difficulty.
Because he asked him, you know, the cab driver guy said, what kind of education you have? You know, he said, you know, some here, some there, you know.
And that's it. And it's all part of putting that picture together of this guy who doesn't have all of his wheels on the track.
Yeah. Well, we missed we didn't talk about the scene with him in the mirror talking to himself.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of de-emphasize that one because that's the obvious one.
Yeah.
Yeah. You talk the one that everybody does when you mention that you're going to do Taxi Driver. In fact, Sal did it to me before she went to bed tonight. She came over, you're talking to me? Yes, I'm fucking talking to you. Go away, I'm trying to watch a movie.
But,
and so she did that. I mean, and I was trying to de-emphasize that a little bit because I don't think that's what the most important scene in the movie.
Well,
it's
I mean,
just the one that
it was done so well, though, in the you know, they just let him go with it, improvise, and you know, took stuff out of it. But the thing is, you know, I watched it on TV, but when you watch it in a dark movie theater with a huge screen,
yeah,
it is just such an impact. You get just so sucked into that. I mean, you know, he's pointing that thing right at you in the movie theater, you know.
Yeah, and you don't know who else is sitting in the cinema.
I know, it's like an iconic scene now. And everybody, I mean, that's probably the second, you know, most quoted movie lines and stuff. But when you see it in the theater, I wish I could see it in the theater again. That it really has, I think, to me, more of an impact in the theater.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, to remember with a lot of old films, and I don't think I've mentioned it before, but I probably should, the fact that they weren't made to be seen in your lounge room.
Mm-hmm.
Anything before the 1980s, before VHS and video rooms, it was meant to be seen by people sitting in big rows in front of an enormous screen as a communal experience.
Yeah.
And, I mean, apart from TV movies, allowing for that kind of stuff, but cinema movies were really meant to be seen in a kind of auditorium.
I have to agree with you.
Yeah, it's just a crazily iconic movie, and I'm glad I hadn't seen it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like, you know, your favorite movie. You don't want to watch it too often so it becomes familiar and ordinary. And I think this is definitely that kind of film where you don't want to watch it too often because if you get too used to it, the magic goes away.
Yeah, the very first time you see it, I think, is the – that's why I think, you know, the big screen – you know, viewing of it's really, really killer. It's all, there's a lot of stuff going on in it too. You know, you talk about the American gun obsession, you know, and all the, you know, we've been into guns over here since like day one. They even talk about, you know, that film, The Great Train Robbery, that the silent movie at the end, he's pointing the gun right at the crowd and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah. And the way that Travis gets the guns is kind of interesting too. The guy who sells them to him is a kind of like a small businessman almost.
You know that guy, you know about that guy?
Steve Prince.
Yeah. He wasn't even an actor.
Easy Andy. No, Easy Andy, the character was called.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was a hustler to the max and just carrying around two suitcases full of guns.
No, I'm saying in real life, he was a friend of Scorsese's. He wasn't even an actor. He's a guy that was like a junkie and did all this stuff. But you can go on YouTube, Scorsese, and I think in 78 made a little documentary about him. It's called American Boy, A Profile of Stephen Prince. And it's Scorsese sitting there, and there he's talking to him about his life, and he's telling stories. And he has this one story he talks about when they were drug addicts, about injecting adrenaline into the heart of this woman who had overdosed with the help of a medical dictionary and a magic marker. And that's the thing that Tarantino put in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
That part.
Cool. I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, it's really wild. They said it was kind of like a lost documentary, but it's on YouTube. I watched a couple parts of it. But he really like did that part well, too. And he wasn't even an actor. He was just a crazy junkie guy that Scorsese knew.
Well, yeah, Scorsese himself was admitted to having a great fondness for cocaine at the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in those years, everybody was doing everything, you know.
Yeah, but he really kind of pulled back from it. He had a bit of a meltdown after New York, New York, and that's in Julia Phillips' book as well.
Mm-hmm.
She likes Scorsese a lot, but there was a time around kind of from this film through New York, New York, and just afterwards where he was bug-fuck crazy and certifiable. And in spite of that, he made good films, but... Scorsese himself admits it that he was off the rails then and really did have to kind of come back from that. And, I mean, I enjoyed Hugo, in fact.
That's an excellent movie.
Yeah, I didn't see it in 3D, but I did see it on Blu-ray. And I'm actually looking at the Blu-ray of it now. And, it's just about the love of cinema as much as anything else.
Yeah,
and the fact is, I mean, there's not a Scorsese film that you really walk away from going, that was a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
Even his lesser films have kind of a density of references and a density of visuals that really do impress me a lot. And one of the best things I did when I started Paleo Cinema was, I got the DVD of his History of American Cinema, which is a documentary. It's on three discs, and it's the ultimate, if you're a podcaster at all or even a movie buff, it's the ultimate documentary to sit down with a pen and paper and write down the names of the films as they come up.
Yeah.
Really, and he also did a great one about the history of Italian cinema, which is really great too. I picked up on Viaggio in Italia, Voyage to Italy with George Sanders and Ingrid Bergman.
Mm-hmm.
I picked up on that from that. And it's just, I've got this thing about any kind of knowledge. There are people who have knowledge about things and vast knowledge about things. There's no point to it unless you share it.
That's very true.
And Scorsese has been incredibly generous in that, and he could keep it all to himself, like a little priesthood of movie makers, but he wants to share the love the same way, in a more flamboyant way, Tarantino does.
In
our own little ways, you and I do.
You know, getting back, I was thinking, we were talking about that gun thing, kind of cut it short, but like you said, that guy was selling the guns, and it was like you said, he was, but he's, you know, oh, this baby, this 38, you could take that out, hammer nails with it all day, it's still, you know.
Yeah.
It was kind of funny, actually, but it wasn't funny, you know. But
it was funny, but appalling.
Yeah. Yes. It's almost like they went through almost like the history of guns, you know. There was, you know, in our movies, when Sam Spade and all that, they had the 38s, and that was popular. And in the 70s, you know, it was like the 44 Magnum. And, you know, it's like America has this eroticism with weapons, guns and stuff, you know. But it's like they went through the whole series of like all the guns that was ever in movies and stuff. It's really, really kind of odd. So I think it was a homage to all the movies and guns and movies or something.
Yeah, and speaking of that, just to go off on a tangent, which I frequently do, as you know, they found out one of the, you know, the American drones that come over and any kind of surveillance drone,
mm-hmm.
they found out the best thing to knock them down with isn't a gun. It's a slingshot with a ball bearing. Because apparently it's slow and massive and cheap to get.
Uh-huh.
You know, you don't have to. You can hide a slingshot better than you can hide a gun, and you can acquire a slingshot easier than you can hire a gun in a third world country. So shooting any kind of surveillance drone with a ball bearing and a slingshot works. It's a David and Goliath thing, but it actually works.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah, it is. Anyway, we probably should wrap that up. We've been doing almost an hour of this and gushing
about Yeah.
I think it's good work, and I'm surprised I'm holding up as well as I am. I could talk another hour about it, but we're going to repeat ourselves. So you're doing First Men in the Moon.
Yep. Tomorrow morning,
mm-hmm. your time. Yep. Later today, my time. Look forward to that one. Anything else you got coming up that's going to be a bit cool? If you guys think that far ahead?
Next week we're having Mark Mostyn is a friend of ours from England. He's the guy that introduced us to Harryhausen, took us to his house and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a friend of Ray's. He's been hanging around with him probably the last, I don't know, 7-10 years or something. He helped him, you know, put all the stuff into the museum, and he knows a lot of people. So we're going to have him on. I think we're going to do Came from Beneath the Sea or whatever. But that should be pretty good because he gives a lot of Ray Harryhausen stories. So that should be fun.
Oh, great. Yeah, that I'll look forward to that one too. But anyway, Vince, thanks for roping yourself in for this podcast.
Yeah, thanks for staying up at these god-awful hours.
No, it kind of works. You know, it makes me feel a little like Travis Bickle to do it.
I may
go cruising the streets looking for child prostitutes to rescue or something after I finish this.
All right. Well, I really enjoyed it. It was fun. Like you said, you could talk about these. It flies by, you know, the time.
So. It does, and it's just a joy to get somebody as much into it as I am. So I really appreciate it. We will do this again.
All right, sounds good, Terry.
Okay, well, you take care of yourself. Love to Mary.
Okay, and love to Sal, and you get some sleep.
I will, mate. Take care of yourself.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
She lives on Madonna Street in a house tucked away there. So small and sweet, though the rug's a little threadbare, and a stairway corkscrews up in the middle of the band. She lives on Dunn Street with me. I drive a taxi cab. Her bedroom's filled with filigree, with candles dancing in the air, cupids floating everywhere. You can smell the sandalwood incense. She glides about in radiance, and when she breathes, I feel a stab. The candles shimmer in the air. I drive the taxicab. Her bed is big enough for three. One of her and two of me. A bar that's filled with everything. From old Brandad to Hennessy, there's one black cat, five Pekingese. The hi-fi's playing modern jazz. Her bed is big enough for three, but me, I drive the taxi cab. There are the tenants in that house, a captain of the artillery, a priest who chews cheese like a mouse, a guru who will serve you tea, a financier from Kathmandu, a pornographer whose eyes are bad. I know what each of them wants to do, but me, I drive the taxi cab. She's got eyes like blazing suns, her hips in song with faded tunes, her ass rolls like twin waterfalls, lives in
That, as any good Francophile knows, was Mort Schumann singing Taxi Cab from the movie version of Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, which I recommend as an interesting little French musical about the music of Jacques Brel. It's available on DVD in Australia. I'm not sure whether it is in other countries, but it does have features of interest, and there's a couple of reasons why I play that. First off, the taxicab reference. Secondly, tomorrow, as I speak, is Bastille Day. And being the intense Francophile that I am, I thought I would play that. It's time now for the feedback. The redoubtable Dr. Zom sent me some feedback via the Paleo Cinema Cafe page on Facebook. And he said, you should not argue with Alfred Hitchcock on the air. He is dead and he's still got the best of you. Well, thanks for that, Zom. Yeah, the fact that he's dead is probably more relevant than the fact that he got the best of me. Though I was trying to be gracious to a guest on the podcast, as indeed you know, having been one. But thanks for the feedback on that, mate. And I will catch up with you at some later time and maybe get you back on the podcast as well so you can spread some of your thick and brown wonderfulness onto Paleo Cinema again. That, of course, was a reference to the little cut-up on with me chatting with Alfred Hitchcock at the start of the last Paleo Cinema podcast. It's nice to note that somebody reacted to it. Not many people did. In fact, I'm pretty fairly almost sure that Zom was the only one who did. Ian Fryer did provide some feedback as well. Let me bring that up. Thanks, Ian, by the way. It says, so after listening to your review of Slaughter, the Jim Brown movie, remember, I was wondering to myself just what the appeal of Jim Brown was, as having seen him in The Dirty Dozen and 100 Rifles, great film, it surely can't have been his acting. The missus is a few years older than me, and she was a regular moviegoer when his films would turn up at a local flea pit. I asked her if people actually said to each other, let's go see the new Jim Brown film. She got a faraway look in her eyes and a funny little smile and said, depended on how much you fancied him. So that must have been, thanks for that, Ian, that must have been the reason why. Jim Brown was a very good-looking guy, and as I mentioned last month, when I reviewed Slaughter, he moved fantastically well. He was, because of course, he had been a professional athlete. Jim Brown did have that kind of kinetic interestingness that really does attract women. So, of course, I think maybe he's had a little bit of the same thing. There were a lot of women I remember back in the day who really loved Sidney Poitier. Now, you've got to remember, this is back in the 60s and 70s when finding a man of colour attractive was a kind of taboo. But I remember my mum did like Sidney Poitier for that reason, and a few other people as well. So maybe it's a little bit of that too. Not only is Jim Brown in this case an attractive looking guy back in the day, but to find him attractive was an act of rebellion in a sense for people in white Western cultures. So yeah, that's an interesting point. And Ian, thank you for your wife, whose name you didn't mention, by the way, for that feedback about Jim Brown, and it does explain much. Ian also threw another email my way soon afterwards, and it says to me, I've just been in Hertfordshire doing some work on my Gerry Anderson magazine, FAB, and was taken to an old bookshop by my mate Mike, who I edit with. We found original cinema brochures for This Is Cinerama and Cinerama Holiday. As it happens, I live around the corner from the world's only regularly operating Cinerama screen at the National Museum in Bradford, and they are two of the films they show there. I had a word with Duncan, the head projectionist there, and they're really interested. I might even get the £20 I spent back, but that's not really the point. I saw The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm there a couple of years ago in Cinerama, and it looked amazing, even with the decrepit state of the only surviving print. Yeah, thanks for that. Cinerama's an interesting one. That three-screen process is really one of those things that they were trying to do to defeat television, of course, and there are only a really limited number of films made in the process, and they did change it around a lot too. I think the How the West Was Won was done in a somewhat different process than the earlier films like Wonderful World and the Brothers Grimm and Cinerama or Holiday, and This Is Cinerama. But I kind of like that. I like failed experiments in cinema where they're trying to give you more the early days of the old school 3D processor is a case in point, where they went out of their way in movies like House of Wax to really kind of emphasize the fact that it was 3D and have that guy with the ping pong battle and the ball on it, whacking it at the screen and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, Cinerama's great. It'd be lovely to see a movie in Cinerama. I'm not sure I ever did. In fact, I'm fairly sure I didn't. And going back in my childhood, the Brothers Grimm was on in the Cinerama cinema in Sydney at the time. So there was a possibility I might have seen it, but I'm fairly sure I would have remembered. And I do kind of like that movie too, with Lawrence Harvey and Carl Boehm in it. And I think Buddy Hackett was in it as well. Wonderful World of Brothers Grimm. Does turn up on TCM here occasionally, so I'm really going to have to put it on the PVR when it comes out and revisit it. I did see How the West Was Won recently, and it does kind of emphasize that one big flaw with Cinerama in that close-ups aren't really good in that format because people's heads are enormous, and the cameras had to be, all three of them, had to be right up into the actor's face to get things clear, and that kind of constricted the actors a little bit in trying to conduct a scene while you've got this enormous fucking machine jammed up your nostril. So yeah, but that's good. That's a good find. That 20 quid's not bad for the brochures. Even if you did sell them on eBay, I'm sure you could get much more than that. There are a lot of Cinerama fans up there. I think there is a guy in Australia who's got a Cinerama projector and has a Cinerama home theatre system. I'd have to look that up online. But yeah, really interesting format. And thanks for that one, Ian. Dave Brandt sent an email when he heard that Vince and I were going to do Taxi Driver. And he wanted to suggest movies that we would talk about alongside Taxi Driver. So here's Dave's email. Hey, Terry, I don't have any feeling one way or the other about rolling your two podcasts into one feed. I've subscribed to both of them, so they show up automatically whatever you do. It's both Films with Frost for me. That's a reference back to my old movie gig with Ivor in ABC Darwin. It's cool to get Vince on your podcast, but I suppose I agree that the Scorsese movie isn't especially paleo. So my suggestion is to balance it out with something ultra-paleo. I always thought of Taxi Driver as the best example of post-Hitchcock. So the counterbalance is a film that was made when Hitchcock became Hitchcock. The first true Hitchcock movie, of course, was The Lodger. Innocent Man on the Run goes well with North by Northwest. Before that, he was trying to impress Alma Revel, his wife, of course. We'll make a nice book into Taxi Driver. Both films are shot by great directors very early in their careers, and both pictures were heavily influenced by their elders. Of course, Hitchcock was trained partly at UFA Studios in Germany, which was state-of-the-art stuff at the time. But back to Dave. What's fascinating about Blackmail is it's a huge influence, hugely influenced by the German silent expressionists who taught Hitchcock how to make suspension pictures. Even though it was only 1929, Hitchcock actually used speech subjectively. Other directors were lucky just to get the audio track down. It's a little glimpse of what could have happened to talkies if they had continued the expressionistic style instead of getting literal. And the knifing scene bears a certain similarity to one in Dial M for Murder, but I can't quite put my finger on it. Regards, Dave Brandt. Yeah, thanks for that, Dave. After you sent that email, I thought, next podcast, I'm going to have to do something at least 40s and 50s to keep the paleo thing happening. Though, if somebody is somewhat younger than me, anything made in the 70s is paleo enough, but from the perspective of we gentlemen of a certain age, yeah, I agree. Well, I've got to kind of keep it so that I'm covering all of the waterfront, all the way from, say, 1993, which is where paleo cinema stops now, all the way back to things like The Lodger and Blackmail. I did see a documentary that Matthew Sweet did for the BBC that covered a lot of that stuff. It's called Silent Britain, if you can find a torrent of it. And it goes through the history of silent films in Britain and right up to The Lodger with Ivor Novello, the silent version that Hitchcock did. And it talks a little bit about how Ivor Novello lived with his mum and his boyfriends in a nice little house in London and all that sort of thing. So it does go into a little bit of the history of that. But thanks for that one, Dave, and really is appreciated that I'm getting some feedback, which is a lovely, wonderful, and heartwarming thing. And at the moment, with the weather as it is outside, cold and wet, heartwarming is not a bad thing. So that was about it for the feedback. Now, as I said earlier, tomorrow is Bastille Day. Aujourd'hui it's not, but tomorrow is. See, I'm learning my French lessons via Duolingo, so I'm throwing occasional French words into things to an annoying extent. But anyway, I'm going to finish off with another piece of French chanson. Just give me a moment to figure out which one I'm going to do. Yep, just figured it out. I'm going to do Georges Ormel's classic song about the red light district in Paris, Pigalle. Now, I'll give you the translation of the first two lines of the lyrics just to keep you up to date. Let's see what I've got there. I'm bringing the lyrics up. Here we go. Un petit château is a little fountain. Une station de métro entourée de bistrots, a metro station surrounded by restaurants. Pigalle, there you go. So I'm just going to play it now and say goodbye. So enjoy yourselves on Bastille Day and further into the fortnight. I'm going to spend tomorrow, Bastille Day, watching French films, I've decided, just for the fuck of it. I haven't decided which ones yet. I may throw The Young Girls of Rochefort in there because it's my favourite French film. But I have things like The Horde and a couple of other things. And I have The Professional, which has got another name, Leon, with Jean Reno, so I'm going to definitely watch that tomorrow. But anyway, here is Georges Ormel with Pigalle, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with the Martian Drive-In podcast.
Ghetto, une station de métro entourée de bistrots, Pigalle. Grand magasin, atelier de rapin, restaurant pour Rupin, Pigalle. Là, c'est le chanteur des carrefours qui fredonne le succès du jour. Ici, l'athlète en maillot qui soulève les poids de 100 kilos. Hôtel meublé, discrètement éclairé, où l'on ne fait que passer, Pigalle. Et vers minuit, un refrain qui s'enfuit d'une boîte de nuit, Pigalle. L'on y croise des visages communs ou sensationnels. L'on y parle des langages connus à la tour de Babel. Et quand vient le crépuscule, c'est le grand marché d'amour, c'est le coin où déambulent ceux qui prennent la nuit pour le jour. Girls et mannequins, gitanes aux yeux malins, qui lisent dans les mains, Pigalle. Clochard, camelot, tenancier de tripot, trafiquant de coco, Pigalle. Petite femme qui vous sourit en vous disant tu viens chérie. Et Prosper qui dans son coin discrètement surveille son gagne-pain. Un petit ghetto, une station de métro entourée de bistrots, Pigalle. Et vers minuit un refrain qui s'enfuit d'une boîte de nuit, Pigalle. Une station de métro entourée de bistrots, Pigalle. Sa vie, sa gueule, les gens diront ce qu'ils veulent, mais comme on vient qu'un seul.